And tonight it gives me great pleasure, all the way from Santa Maria, to welcome Lexi to the podium. Give her a round.
All right. This is absolutely terrifying. I've watched a lot of people do this, and it already looks a lot easier than it is. All right. Let's get weird. Lexi, alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 11th, 2023, so I have just over 16 months.
2022.
I mean, yes. This is why you're here, Billy. That's my sponsor. It's already off to a great start. All right, May 11th, 2022, I have just over 16 months of sobriety. My home group is the happy hour meeting at the 1600 Club in Santa Maria, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. Starting in childhood, I suppose. I grew up in Colorado in a small suburb outside of Denver called Arvada. I was born to two young parents. They had my sister at 18 and 20 years old, and then I came along when they were 20 and 22. So being young parents, they didn't have much patience for children, and they were still kind of like in their party phase. And it was a pretty abusive and dysfunctional environment, mentally, physically, and emotionally abusive. So being in their party phase, we mostly stayed with my grandparents until I was about 8 years old. And when we did start staying with my parents, it was just like a lot of partying in the house. My sister is a year older than me, so when she was in school, my parents were at work. They had their dealer friends, like, just drive me around all day and do what they did. And they would constantly rent out our basement to their friends who would do drugs and drink and party, like, with the kids, us kids in the house. So I've seen addiction from the very start. And I also went to a lot of overdose funerals at a very young age. So I saw quickly what the addiction can do to you, but at that time I was young, so I obviously didn't understand the full capacity of it. On the other hand, I had my great aunt and uncles. They were the alcoholics of the family. And they put the one idea that I ever had of an alcoholic in my head. And that was basically waking up in the morning, drinking vodka and Coors Light, a gallon of vodka and Coors Light all day from sunrise to sunset. And that's the only vision that I ever had of an alcoholic in my head. They also gave me my first drink at 10 years old, and it was apple pie moonshine. And I thought that was the coolest thing when I was younger, but it wasn't. So eventually, one died of a heart attack, another one from cancer, and the last one died homeless on a sidewalk. That was all from their drug and alcohol use. And I'm also the first alcoholic addict in my family to get help and get sober. So I take a lot of pride in that. My teenage years. I started smoking weed at 15, like straight out of the soda can. But I did fear like the hard drugs and alcohol still. I had no interest in that. So between the fear that I had instilled in me, because my family did tell us, don't be like us. They told the grandkids, don't drink, don't do drugs, don't be like us. So I did have that fear instilled in me still. And I was also on the cheer team in high school, so they were pretty strict with the partying. So I didn't party in high school. I graduated, and I met my first love. You know, you're 18, you think it's the love of your life. And that love introduced me to my second and third love, which was drug and alcohol and the lifestyle behind it. I was still pretty sheltered, and I didn't, like, although I had been around it, you know, I didn't understand it. So older, I had to like get to know addiction, if that makes sense. Like, people had to show me how to do these things. I ended up selling cocaine with his cousin for about a year, and the dealers above us tried to kidnap me, so I thought that's probably not a good idea anymore. But, you know, two addicts dating, It doesn't work. We were constantly like on come downs or hungover, so we were agitated. We had anger problems, and ultimately we did break up due to our addictions. At that time, I'm about 19, and I decided to stop drinking and using, and I enrolled into medical school to be a surgeon. I finished one semester, and I had 5 family members die in a month, and I absolutely lost my mind. I spiraled, dropped out, and pursued addiction again instead of a career. And I say addiction now because I know now that's what it was, but at the time I was just trying to numb myself. I didn't know what else to do. So after that, my dating pattern started. I reunited with this kid, Tyler. I went to school with him my whole life. That was like my school crush. But he was also an addict. So again, we enabled each other. His addiction was a little more extreme than mine at the time. So I was throwing him under the bus to our family so I could hide mine, my addiction. And I did eventually leave that situation too. January 21st of this year, Tyler died from this disease. And I have a lot of guilt behind that. I didn't understand our disease at the time, but now knowing what I know, it did put more into focus that there's really only 2 ways out of this addiction, and it's the program or death. So I'm choosing the program. Quickly, though, I learned to stay dating addicts because, number one, they're not going to tell me to not drink or use. And number two, I could live with them. My parents wouldn't know where I was. My parents and my family had no idea where I was, and they wouldn't be able to tell me to stop drinking or using. So the pattern basically became enabling, it got toxic, and then empty. And then it just ended. So, all right. At this time, I'm 21, and I am waitressing, I'm serving drinks in a strip club, and my mother called it the devil's den. And she was right. That place is the devil's den. That led me to drinking and using like daily. I learned there that I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know how to say no, which I'm sure that's all of us. I can't say no, and then when I'm in a blackout, I still drink when I'm in a blackout. So I quickly learned, you know, if I lean on the other substances, I could stay out of a blackout longer, and I could drink longer, and I could stay conscious for work. I ended up being hospitalized with a kidney and liver infection. I was weighing 98 pounds, like soaking wet, and I had a fever of 102. And all the doctors and nurses were like, you need to stop drinking. Like, that's your problem. You need to stop drinking. Well, I left the hospital, and I went straight back to work for a tequila tasting. The Patron reps were coming in, okay? You can't say no to free drinks. So I went and did that. Eventually, I was spending all my money on alcohol and drugs. I was falling behind on rent, and I obviously wasn't eating. So I did start stripping for money to support my habit. And I could say that was the sketchiest, most dangerous, and degrading thing I did for drugs and alcohol. I literally felt like I was selling my soul to get loaded. So I'm not proud of that, but, and at the time I still didn't think I had a problem. I was also, stealing from, lying to, and manipulating my family to the point where I was no longer allowed around them, not in their houses. They blocked my numbers. They changed the locks. I would break in through windows. They would lock the windows, you know, and it just was, you know, I was abusing my family as well as myself. So since I couldn't steal from them anymore, I was locked out of the houses, right? Couldn't steal from them anymore. So I got really desperate and just started stealing directly from my dealers. And my dealers came from the club. So they weren't just like, you know, your friend down the street that you know, that you can just steal something and be like, oh, don't do that again, buddy. They were like for real scary drug dealers. So I stole from three of them. One of them put a hit out on me to get my, to cut my face. They wanted my face cut. I got a text from somebody, like somebody who was willing to pick up that $1,500 saying, you know, we know your location, we're watching you, and I want that $1,500. And I texted back, asked for more money. I thought I thought it was a joke at the time. And I told him, ask for more money. I'm worth way more than $1,500. What are you talking about? So I did it again. I stole from a second one, and word of mouth told me there was this party that we were all supposed to go to, and he told a few people he was going to shoot and kill me, and I was still going to go. You know, I had no fear. I was still going to go, and I got called in to cover a shift at work, so I did that, and that man shot and killed someone, mistaking them for me. So I also have a lot of guilt for that, too. And he is in prison for life now. And the last one, because I still didn't learn my lesson, he beat me up on the side of the club with, like, a chain. My jaw was partially dislocated, and I had a ruptured eardrum. So I'm permanently deaf. And I finally learned my lesson after that one, I think, kind of. But that is the thing with me. I always have to learn the hard way. I always have to push the limit, you know. So I kept finding myself in just really, really bad situations. That club is really where my addiction was at its worst, because like I said, my mom called it the devil's den, and it is. The movies make them look real cool, but if you know the behind the scenes, it's not. A friend of mine, me and a friend from there, we went to go get a drink before work at a different bar, and we told ourselves we're going to get one drink, we're going to go take a nap, we're going to go to work. Well, some guys offered to buy us drinks, and something in my head told me, like, no, we shouldn't take those. And she kept saying, who cares, who cares, we don't have much money anyways, just have them buy us a drink. And I said, okay, sure. And it was the only drink that we had that day, because we didn't even get one for ourselves. So they ordered us our drinks, and she's like, let's go to the bathroom and do a line. I said, no, let's wait. What if they drug us, right? No, it's fine. It'll be fine. And so we went into the bathroom, and they did drug us. And they drugged us. We woke up in different hotel rooms alone. They had raped us and put money in our clothes, and they were nowhere to be found. So, I don't know if anybody's ever been drugged, but you kind of go in and out of consciousness, and you can't help it, you can't keep yourself out of it. So eventually a coworker of mine found me just laying on a sidewalk in the middle of downtown Denver. And the way they found me was because they tracked, I didn't show up for work, and I always showed up for work. And they tracked my location on Snapchat, and he found me just passed out on the sidewalk. He took me to the hospital and stuff, and yeah. And I know no one deserves that. Nobody ever deserves to be in a situation like that. But, you know, if I don't want to excuse it, so this is not like an excusing thing. But if I hadn't have prioritized, you know, doing drugs in the bathroom, or if I would have just bought my own damn drink, you know, that wouldn't have happened. And it's funny, too, because this situation, I trauma blocked it out. And somebody in another speaker meeting mentioned that we don't talk about it much, but a lot of alcoholics seem to have been sexually assaulted at some point, and it triggered it. And so that's something I'm going to have to work through. But with that being said, I was always willing to risk it all for a drink, anything. That was just where I got to. I knew the danger of it, and I did it anyways. Okay. Shortly after that, my family moved here to Santa Maria. And they told me I could move here with them if I was ready to get sober. Them moving to me was just like they're getting off my back, and I don't have to hide what I'm doing anymore. And it only took about 2 months until I became homeless. I was sleeping in a park. And I just kept running into trouble constantly. At this time, I was 22, and I was just, like, defeated and decided to move to Santa Maria. So when I got here, I had a roof over my head. I had food, a bed. I felt safe for the first time in a long time. And this was my first opportunity that was given to me to get sober. I thought about sobriety, but, you know, I'm sitting here. I don't know anybody in this town when I moved here. I didn't know a single person. And I thought to myself one night, how would I even find a dealer if I wanted to, you know? Because my addictions go hand in hand. I can't do one without the other. So I thought, how would I even find a dealer if I don't know anybody? And it became like a challenge. Like, I challenged myself at that point. Well, now I got to find one, you know? And I did. Within 2 weeks of moving here, I found a dealer. And then 2 months later, I had a DUI. I had wrecked my parents' car. I was driving it while I was on fire. When I got caught, I lied to the cops and said I wasn't the one driving. You know, I ditched the keys and got seatbelted myself in the passenger seat and said that wasn't me. And I was in a blackout. So I did go to jail. I went, I had all those DUI programs. But it was my first introduction to AA on a court card at 22. And, you know, I went for a while. I stayed in the back. If somebody asked me who I was like, oh, I'm Lexi and I'm on a court card. Like, I was not going to say I was an alcoholic. I was not going to be one of you. So somebody eventually in the rooms asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic. And I said, you know, I'm not really sure. And he read me the description of the alcoholic. And he said, if when you honestly want to find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And then he asked me again, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I just kind of sat there silently. I like froze because I knew that was me. And he just said, keep coming back. I did the opposite, though. I forged my card and got the hell out of there. And I was not going to look back. Looking back now, I know I just didn't have that willingness, honesty, or open-mindedness that's needed to succeed in this program. So I didn't look back. 4 months later, after another failed relationship in that same pattern with an addict, I got that defeated feeling again. And I thought, I want to get sober. And I asked him, will you get sober with me? He said, no. I said, okay, bye. I'm getting sober. And I did. So my original sobriety date is August 4th of 2020. I had a year and 8 months dry. And I say dry because I wasn't in the program. I wasn't planning on going to AA because if I went to AA, then they would know I was an alcoholic. Everyone would know I was an alcoholic. And that one guy, you know, he was already on to me. So I still had all those character defects, you know, like the anger, ego, resentments, dishonesty, and like all those, anything you could think of. So within that time of being dry, I got in a car accident and I almost died. First, everyone thought it was my fault because I'm a drunk driver. I didn't just do it that one time that I got caught. I just got caught finally. But I did it so many other times, you know. And I did it after that DUI too. So everyone thought like, oh, you were drunk. And so I'm being accused of being drunk when somebody else had hit and ran me and left me on the road to die. And, you know, I can't be mad at that because that's what any rational person would think I did. With my history. So, I had a lot of trauma, obviously, from that. I still am going through that. But I had a lot of trauma and still all those character defects that I hadn't figured out what to do with. And the only way I knew how to like deal with those was with drinking and using. That's how I numb things, right? So, although I wasn't thinking about relapse, the opportunity came to me. And I know the other day we were talking about in a meeting how alcohol is a subtle foe. And boy, is it. Because I wasn't thinking about it. But, you know, I'm not working. I'm not driving. I'm home alone all day. And my neighbors were like, hey, we got some beer. You want to come over? And in less than 30 seconds, I was in their doorway. And I knew at the time it wasn't going to be a good idea. Because even though I still didn't think I had a problem, I knew that, like, I got too rowdy when I drank. Because a lot of people would tell me, like, why do you do that? You know? But I separated it as, like, oh, I just have a problem saying no. And it's the same thing, you know? But I had to separate it in my mind because I was not going to be an alcoholic. So, I relapsed. On May 9th, 2022. May 10th, I was still drunk. So May 11th, I went to AA. I was sober, and I knew I needed help. So acceptance is the first lesson I learned here. I'm grateful that my drinking career was like 8 years, because when I walked into the rooms, you know, I had a hard time accepting that I was 26 at the time. I'm 26. I'm in my 20s, and I have to get sober. I can't party. All my friends are partying. Can't hang out with them anymore. You go on social media, you see it everywhere, you know? So I had a hard time accepting that I have to go the rest of my life without drinking or using. And I still struggle with that sometimes, because that's a long time. And when I went into the room, you know, I see people in their 50s and 60s, and they're like, oh, we got here like a few years ago. And I'm like, yeah, you guys got to party still. Like, you guys did it the right way, you know? So, acceptance is the first lesson I learned. I had to accept that I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. I had to accept that I was an alcoholic, and I had to identify myself in the rooms I was in. So, I would sit in the back and cry. And I would raise my hand and say, alcoholic, and cry. And then I wouldn't talk to anybody. I had my head down. And then, you know, eventually I moved to the tables and cried. And then I started talking to people and crying to those people. But eventually, you know, the crying does stop, okay? And most importantly, you know, I still had to accept that I need the help. I didn't want the help, but I knew I needed it because whatever I was doing wasn't right. You know, being dry, I knew that wasn't the right way to go because I was miserable. So this program taught me that, like it says in the big book, acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact in my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, or thing. I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. Now, when I first got there, and I was crying in the chair in the corner, I told myself, I looked up at these and I said, that's Chinese. I don't know what the fuck that says. I cuss, sorry, Stan. I don't know what what that is, but like, I'm not doing that. I won't do that. And I made a promise to myself, we're not doing that. And whatever his sponsor is, I don't need a babysitter. I'm not doing that. And eventually I wore down and I realized I did need a sponsor and I did work the steps. That led me to learning humility. The big book says they only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, honesty, in the sense we had to find it necessary until they told someone else all of their life story. So until today, only like 2 people knew this whole story. And so that's why I was horrified, because I am horrified by my story. But this is pretty freeing now that I'm up here. It's like another weight lifted off my shoulders. So when I took my step 4 inventory, I needed to learn that I needed that humility to learn that there's a better way to live, and it's not my way. It's God's way, but my way is rough. But I didn't understand what God's way was yet. I always had a higher power, God, but I struggled. I was mad at God. I was so mad at God. Me and God used to fight a lot. So in that inventory step, I read that in the big book that a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke, and that the inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and were willing to set these matters straight. So in my drinking and using, my famous words were, "I didn't do it." And that's still an ongoing joke in my family. Like, I'll walk in the door and they'll be like, "Oh, she didn't do it." Because I said it so much, you know. Whether I was in that car that was on fire, which was not my car, it was my parents' car, or in handcuffs. Like, I remember when I got my DUI, I came out of my blackout while I was in jail, and I was telling the cop I didn't do it. And I was, like, in handcuffs trying to get them out. And he was like, "All right, you did, though. You're on camera." Or when I was stealing, you know, my family, "Where did this go?" I don't know. I didn't do it. I didn't take it. And I did. So nothing was ever my fault. Even my addiction, you know, in the environment that I grew up in, I feared it from it. But at the same time, I tried to use it as like, well, you guys put me in that situation, so what did you expect? And I don't think that way anymore. So today, I'm able to take accountability and be honest with myself and others, which was very hard for me to do. But now I shared one time in a meeting that I love honesty so much, I'm about to start snitching. And that didn't go over well, but, you know. So I'm on my third round of steps in 16 months. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that because I'm insane. And I've learned that when I'm having a hard time, I'm out of alignment somewhere. And those steps, those are your solution to whatever's going funky in your brain, in your life, whatever. That those solutions are in there somewhere. Notice I said I was out of alignment because I'm taking my inventory, not anyone else's. I'm taking accountability now. Okay. The steps that are most important to me are step 10 and 11. Step 10, continue to take more personal inventory, and when you were wrong, promptly admit it. This step really calmed me down, because I came, although I was crying in the corner, once I got out of that crying stage, I kind of came out swinging. I was angry at everybody. I hated everybody in this program. And I wasn't going to listen to a bunch of old people tell me what to do. It very much calmed me down. I had a horrible attitude. But with more practice, today I could keep my mouth shut. And that's a big thing, because I always got something to say about everybody else. You know, not myself, but everyone else. So now I can keep my mouth shut and mind my business. And also just keep my house in order. And that's the focus there is, you know, keep my house in order. Don't worry about anyone else. Keep my mouth shut and mind my business. I do slip up on that. But I can say when I do find myself like kind of getting like pissy with someone, I can take a second and be like, okay, that was wrong. And then I can go, you know, do those amends when needed. So I've gotten pretty good at that one. And then step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. So those previous steps up to 11 helped my relationship with my higher power. Now, see, I was mad at God because I blamed God for all the positions I put myself in. All those people that wanted to kill me, that was God's fault. Why would he do that to me? My car accident, why would you do that to me? I was finally, you know, after I opened my mind to step 11, I became more awake, aware, and I could see like the bigger picture of things. Step 11 is what will continue to improve that relationship, because it's not great still, if I'm being honest. It's not great. But I am learning to be willing to grow along spiritual lines. I do meditate in the mornings, though. My therapist recommended that to me, because I do get outside help, and I'm a big advocate for outside help, too. But we call it my happy hour. And it's the first hour in the morning. I just do positive things and like meditate and calm down. And it usually puts me on a straight and narrow path for the day, you know. And then if I do find myself being disturbed by those people, places, and things, I can just take a step back, breathe, do a little bit of meditation, and then, you know, start my day over. I don't let anything ruin my day anymore, because that was a big thing in my addiction, was I looked for problems. If you looked at me wrong, fuck you, I'm gonna go drink about it. And, I don't do that anymore. So, I do struggle with praying, and I'll tell you why. When I was younger, we would pray, because I did have God in my life, and my grandparents would have us pray before bed, and we would do a bunch of prayers, but we would say, you know, lay your healing hands on, and then we'd list the family members that we had that were sick. And I had convinced myself that if I forgot someone and they died, it was my fault. So I didn't want to pray anymore. That was a trap. Someone was going to die. And also, my whole life, when I got in a car, because I feared driving my whole life, when I got in a car, I would pray, please, please, dear Lord, please keep me safe on the road and everyone around me. Well, I prayed the day, you know, before I left for my accident, and I almost died. So again, fuck you, God. Why'd you do that to me? So I struggle with praying, but my sponsor has taught me like simple prayers. He's worked baby steps. Taught me that there's a real simple proactive one, and it's just saying thank you. Thank you, God. And I can do that one, you know? We're also working on me praying for other people. I have a lot of resentments. It's like as soon as I drop one, I pick another one up. So we're always praying for other people, but we have to do it together. I'm still not there to do it alone. I repeat after him, and then we let go of the resentment together. I do know that God has my best interest now, because all those times I should have died, I didn't. And that was God. God was keeping me alive. He had a plan for me. I still don't know that plan, other than sobriety, but we're here. I'm alive to find my plan. This time goes fast. So I heard an analogy the other day about sobriety, and sobriety is kind of like getting in a pool. So there's three ways to get into a pool. One is you dip your toes in. You say, that's cold, I'm not doing that, and you don't go get in the pool. The second one is like going down the stairs, you know, one stair at a time, getting used to it, go to another one, getting used to it. And that's kind of like those of us that go in and out of the rooms, you know, we're just torturing ourselves. We can't decide if we want to go in or get out of the pool. And the last way is just jump in, right? You know, it's going to be cold. You know, it's going to be uncomfortable for a second. But once you acclimate to that temperature of the water, you get to have fun. So for me, I learned quickly to just jump into this program. I was very uncomfortable with it, very uncomfortable. I didn't want to talk to anybody still, but I did. I jumped into that pool, and I got very active in our community. So I have seven service commitments, which I'm not recommending that to everyone. It drives me insane sometimes, but I got seven commitments, and I only asked for one. But I learned never to say no to an AA commitment, so I don't. My favorites are, I get to hand out chips at our meeting, and I love that because I get to be like a little piece of everyone's sobriety. That kind of sounded selfish. I don't mean it in that way. I joined I also have a secretary position, and It's funny, I say sometimes in meetings that that coffee pot saved my life. And that sounds so horrible and desperate, but it did. Because when I came in this program, I didn't have a job. I still don't. I can't drive. And that's because I can't, not because I choose to. But, you know, I wasn't working. I don't drive. You know, I don't have friends anymore because I'm not allowed to hang out with those friends. So I would come in and make coffee, you know. And that gave me a purpose. That was finally, I had a purpose after so long. After 2 years, I had a purpose. And I did when I got here, you know. The first month into sobriety, I did try to commit suicide because it wasn't working as fast as a blackout was, you know. You got to stick around longer to see, you know, those promises. And I'll get to that. I also joined the H&I committee. So I bring a meeting just myself to sober living and a recovery shelter. And then I'm working on getting into the jails, and I'm a sponsor. And I know, remember, I said I wasn't going to let anyone help me, and I wasn't going to help anyone else. And I love helping other people now. It does get frustrating sometimes. But and all those commitments, they really do give insurance to your sobriety. And I tell myself, you know, like, there's been times where I just don't want to go, you know? It's my meeting. I'm supposed to open the doors. And I think, well, who's going to open the doors? And granted, someone's going to be there to open the doors. But, like, I have to hold myself accountable. Like, I need to open the doors today. We need to get a meeting. These people need a meeting, you know? So it does ensure your sobriety. And through these commitments, I've also met so many people. And I have built an amazing support system for myself and others. Today, I can say I'm a better person because of this program. I was asked, who am I today? I'm honest, almost to a fault. I'm honest, I'm kind, most of the time. I'm compassionate, I'm driven, I'm loving, and I'm open-minded. And those are things that I never thought I'd be. And they're simple things, you know, like kindergarten basics. But I needed to be brought back to, like, spiritual kindergarten because I didn't know how to be those things anymore. And then those promises. So my 10 minutes. Okay. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And I was. We are going to know a new freedom and new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity. I'm still working on that one. And we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations with juice to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And everything that I've just shared are all those promises. Like, they happen. You just have to stick around for them to happen. You have to put your work into it to get those promises. And they'll come. It's guaranteed if you want them bad enough. You know, they are guaranteed. I don't have much in life, like, materialistically, but spiritually, mentally, emotionally, I feel like I've won the lottery. My attitude and my outlook on life is way more positive. I used to wake up in the morning just pissed off for no reason. No one would talk to me in the morning. You know, my whole family was walking on eggshells. And now I get to watch the sunrise and the birds chirp. And I'm like, you know, a happy old lady on the porch. And I love it. So this program gave me a second chance. A second chance at life. I'm almost done. Okay. I'm going to end with this a little bit early. I saw a quote the other day. And it says, I was never addicted to one thing. I was addicted to filling a void within myself with other things other than my own love. That was my biggest downfall, is I didn't think I had any value. I didn't think I should be loved. I didn't want to love anyone else. I depended on other people's love, but I didn't feel like I deserved it. And today, the only thing that I need is love for myself and for my higher power. So, Lexi Alcoholic.
All right, let's give Lexi another round of applause.